mate? All right.
Yeah, I'm all right.
Enjoy. So let's all grab and let's all enjoy. Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is writer, journalist, translator, Tim Moore. And we're talking about his book, Burning Down the House: Punk Rock, Revolution, and the Fall of the Berlin Wall. Tim, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Thanks, Mark.
How did you compile this information in this book? As I mentioned off mic, I mean, this reads like a diary. It's got an awful lot of personal information, but also from the police records and the Stasi records.
Yeah, I first attacked the Stasi files. I thought that would be my biggest resource. They're really voluminous. The Stasi was extremely paranoid about the punk scene right from the start, so there's a lot of material. But then to write it the way that you're describing, in this kind of cinematic way, it turned out that I needed to interview a lot of people. So I talked to about 50 people, wow. And they were often really long, lengthy interviews. And people also offered up their own personal Stasi files, which are not redacted, because they're allowed to see who informed on them, for instance.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
That must have led to some awkward moments when they found out who informed on them.
There was a lot of trickiness when the wall came down and those records were made available. But I think there's also a fair amount of forgiveness, because the Stasi were really good at their job. And they, for instance, with these kids, they would profile people correctly and pick out kids who could be convinced that they were actually helping their friends. So if you work with us, you're sparing your friends going to jail. You're sparing your friends a beating. And then, of course, they did the opposite, too. If they didn't fall for that, you could say it'd be a shame if your parents lost their jobs or if your sister lost her spot in university, God. That kind of thing.
Now, had you been to East Germany before the fall of the wall?
I arrived 2 years after unification.
And you ended up becoming a DJ.
Yeah, that's what I spent the 90s doing. And that's how I first met these people, actually. It just turned out by coincidence that all the first generation of clubs and bars and galleries, everything that was blossoming over there in the eastern part of Berlin in the 90s, had, for the most part, been set up by former East German punks. And so I just met them coincidentally, and they started to show me some of the materials. And eventually I saw a kind of notebook that a guy had kept under a false drawer bottom during the dictatorship. Jesus. And had a few lyric sheets and photos of him and his friends, and a light bulb just went off.
It's an amazing story. I mean, I'm going to encourage listeners, you have to read this book, but the things that these kids have to go through, and you just remind me, one of the things is if they had lyrics, you know, for their bands, which were obviously friendly, they would have to hide the lyrics. They would have to find some kind of place to stash the lyrics to their songs.
Yep, and a lot of them would also burn their lyric sheets once they'd memorized them, too, because you just did not want to be caught with that kind of anti-government material on your person or in your living space.
Let's talk about East Germany before the fall of the wall. How would you describe East Germany for people who aren't familiar with it today?
Well, I guess you'd call it a police state. I mean, they had it was surprisingly legalistic. I mean, you couldn't just, one of the big comparisons I noticed as I started the research was the fact that, unlike here, the police in East Germany couldn't just kill people. And I think we have that impression that happened a lot in the Eastern Bloc, but it wasn't the case in East Germany. But there were things that were illegal that we would definitely not consider criminal, like defaming the government was something illegal over there. And that's how these punks ran afoul of the authorities often, was because they were doing just stridently anti-government songs.
We were talking about this off mic too. Punks, like in Worcester here in Massachusetts, had a hard time. It was nothing compared to being a punk in East Germany, where you would be arrested, and the things that happened to you when you were arrested, you'd often be grilled for like 2 days. Like put under like relentless grilling, and you'd be arrested, you'd be thrown in jail. Yeah, you wouldn't be killed, but you're sort of brought up to that point. I mean, there are a lot of people who became very depressed and despondent in solitary confinement.
Yeah. Some of these bands went to jail for up to 2 years for their lyrics. And one of the most famous cases that's in the book, the lyrics weren't, they never found lyrics on paper. And the lyrics were provided by informants who'd listened to one of their shows. The shows took place, this is another interesting angle of the story.
Yeah, we'll talk about
all
that.
All the shows took place in churches, which were...
That blew my mind, that there was this sort of weird alliance between churches and punks.
Yeah, Alliance might be selling it a little strongly. I mean, there were a few kind of there were a few ministers and deacons who took in outsider groups into their churches, and they often that caused friction between those ministers and the church hierarchy, because the church hierarchy did not want to be seen as fostering political activity and fostering opposition groups, and yet it was structured such that certain ministers and deacons could do it anyway, and that's what happened. And those people had rough times of it as well. I mean, the minister in Halle who sponsored the very first national punk festival on the grounds of his church, he was openly branded an enemy of the state.
Jeez. Now, the German leader, East German leader at the time, is Erich Honecker. What was his background?
He had started out looking after youth activities in East Germany. So during the Stalinist era, immediately after the war, he was in charge of basically monopolizing youth activity through the various communist youth organizations. And so youth culture was something that was always really fraught with politics in the East. Jeez. And so it's not surprising that he came from that background to become the overall head.
Before the punk movement there, what was it like to be a teenager in East Germany? It seemed sort of seen from your descriptions in the book, your life was sort of dictated what you were going to do. You had your options are very limited.
Yeah, I think one of the best ways to express it is something the punks used to say themselves. British punk, they used to talk about no future because they didn't see a place for themselves in society because of the economic situations. But in the East, the problem was exactly the opposite. They felt their whole life was scripted out for them. They had their communist youth organizations and apprenticeships and mandatory military service and then a job somewhere that they didn't care about. And so what they railed against was too much future.
Too much future. Wow. You know,
they wanted to wrest control of these decisions in their lives.
The thing that I find amazing is you actually know who the first punk in East Berlin was.
Yes.
That's like finding Adam and Eve.
She is an amazing figure. Yeah, she was 15 when she discovered the Sex Pistols in 1977. And by 78, the Stasi had a file on her. The whole scene grew up around her. She influenced people at her school and her neighborhood. And then in early 81, she became one of the first punks that they made an example of. She was arrested, put in jail, put in Stasi prison for a year, and then given a five-year, they called it a Berlin Verbot, so she couldn't go back to East Berlin and see her friends and family. She was sent off to a little tiny little village built around a textile mill where she was expected to work for the next 5 years. And instead she ran away, went back to Berlin, was rearrested, put back in Stasi prison for a year, and then eventually expatriated. They just shipped her off to West Germany to take care of the problem.
I have to imagine the guts it took to be the first punk in East Germany. It's almost like she deserves a special award.
I agree. I think a lot of these people deserve awards. And one of the crazy things is the scene has been basically invisible up to now because they did not seek out contacts in the West during the dictatorship.
Right,
so,
right.
So when the wall fell, they were not in a position to sort of tell the story and become part of the received narrative of the revolution.
I love the stories of when they first heard the music because as a person who loves that music too, it just really touches me. It's like she first hears Sex Pistols Pretty Vacant. And something touches these kids and go, yes, that's the spirit that I want to embody. And it's contrary to everything that's in their society. How are they hearing this music? They're not hearing it over local radio.
That's a really good point. You could pick up Western radio in almost every part of East Germany. So most of them would hear it on British military radio, where they broadcast the John Peel show, for instance.
So I got to name some of the bands. Okay, the Sex Pistols is obvious. X-Ray Specs, Sham 69, The Clash, Coxfire, The Buzzcocks, The Vibrators, The Stranglers, Stiff Little Fingers, The Dickies, Wire. Man, I can't imagine being the first kids to hear that music and living in East Germany. I always picture East Germany as really gray, like gray and cloudy. And to hear that music and then to do something about it just is incredible.
Yeah, the bass player from one of these bands told me that he loved the Ramones because it was the first time he ever heard a record that had no slow songs.
But, you know, it's like classic teenage stuff. I mean, that's where teenagers want to be. That's how they want to act.
Yeah, I mean, the whole scene started out, I think it was fairly similar to the excitement you and I would have felt. It was sort of typical teenage rebellion.
Yeah.
And it was only when they got cracked down on by the secret police that they started to become a really self-consciously political movement.
Yeah, it's amazing what they evolved into. Before we do that, let's talk about the Stasi and who they were and how they operated. Who are the Stasi?
That is the secret police, and they had an extensive domestic surveillance program, and they tried to convert informants in any scene they were interested in examining, or in this case, destroying. One of the mistakes they seemed to make over and over with the punks was they saw all organizations as structured like their own organizations. So they saw everything as hierarchical, and the punks were all sort of self-styled anarchists, and there was no hierarchy. And the Stasi would go looking for the important figures. Often they would go after the singer in the bands, and that was a failure they made over and over again.
It's incredible. What was the equivalent in the Soviet Union at that time?
I haven't researched Soviet.
Was this a very particular East German organization, the Stasi?
Well, they were notorious, I think, for their kind of effectiveness. I think they were regarded as they did their jobs extremely well. They tended to focus on psychological torture, whereas the police were more physical brutality. And so some of the punks who had extensive dealings with the Stasi you can still see lingering effects, I'd say. They have, some of them struggle to deal with daily life after having spent time in Stasi prison.
Jesus. Now, it's amazing. All the people that you interviewed are use names, but they would often use pseudonyms or adopt sort of, I don't know if they were pseudonyms or what you would call, like Amika is one of them. Was part of that to avoid being known by the Stasi too well?
Yeah, I guess there were two reasons. That was obviously extremely practical, so that if you were interrogated by the Stasi and they asked who else was there, and you said, you know, Fatso and Buzzcock, then they have nowhere to go. They're not going to be able to find that person. but it was also kind of a reformation of their personality. So under their normal name, their life was planned out for them. Under this new nickname, this punk nickname, they felt as if they had many more possibilities. Jeez. And they felt that they were basically revolutionaries.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is writer, journalist, translator, Tim Moore, and we're talking about his book. It's an amazing read. Burning Down the House, HAUS, Punk Rock, Revolution, and the Fall of the Berlin Wall. It's amazing how quickly the punk movement turned political. But basically, it was stuff like, I will say what I want to say. I mean, that was considered to be antisocial. Asocial, I think is the word. I mean, that was considered dangerous to be able to sing a lyric like that.
Yeah, I think the Stasi was wary of anyone who was trying to influence people to get off this preordained path. And clearly the punks were doing that from very early on.
Now, let's talk about the bands. The bands are, you know, you always have to keep in mind, and you have to remind people, especially young people today, this is in the days before the internet. I'm amazed they learned about each other. Basically, they would dress the role, though, and so they would visually be able to recognize each other, but that put them at you know, greater danger of being recognized as asocial within the society.
Yeah, it made it easy to spot each other on the street, but it also made you stand out to the police, and it was also one of the main reasons that made them so threatening as a scene, because obviously they were dissident writers and visual artists as well, but they would make their works and then fade back into society. The punks looked to be voicing opposition every time they stepped out in public.
Jesus.
And I think that was what drove the Stasi crazy.
And they looked like classic punks. You have a series of great photographs in the book. And they look like punks that you would see in Britain.
Yep. Yeah, I think it's almost incomprehensible, I think, from a Western perspective.
It is.
that these decisions they were making it as early as 15, 16, 17, and basically throwing away their entire lives in the hopes of being able to cause change within this notoriously locked down society. It's just incredible.
And the amazing thing is how they learned how to look. Somebody would like pick up a Western magazine and there would be a few pictures in there and they would devour that stuff. They would, you know, they would happen to, they didn't see stuff on television. They would see stuff, you know, in magazines that happened to come their way and they would use that as role models.
Yeah, and then they had to do everything themselves. So Major, her first few punk outfits, they involved the chain from a toilet plunger.
I know. That was like, it was really creative. It was really DIY punk, which is supposed to be DIY, but this was the real thing. This was like the genuine DIY punk.
Yeah, yeah. And I think the role that they played later on then was in sort of stealing the resolve of other opposition-minded people. One of the great unknowns in this society was what would happen if you ran afoul of the Stasi, and the punks basically ran the experiment. They they saw what happened, and a lot of them, like I said, some of these bands went to jail for almost 2 years, and yet they came back out and kept fighting for the most part.
Very few of them left
the scene, and that, I think, was a game changer. When everyone else could see that it was possible to resist and survive, that allowed them then to take the protest more and more onto the streets, into the public eye. And then snowball into the mass demonstrations that we saw in 89.
Let's talk about some of the early bands. Like, it's one thing to be a punk, and first of all, how are they getting hold of the music other than on the radio? Are they smuggling cassettes in?
Yeah, they would tape off the radio. There was a guy who was working as a baker's apprentice, so he had overnight hours, and that was often the best radio time on Western radio for somebody who's into punk music, and he would just tape the entire time while he was baking. And then those tapes would get retaped and passed around. But it's important to say, though, also that even though it was sparked by this Western music, it became something uniquely Eastern
very
quickly.
Right.
They started addressing conditions in their own lives, and they were doing it in their own language, and it became a really uniquely Eastern phenomenon, which was another thing that the Stasi failed to understand. Even late into the 80s, they are listing punk as the number one youth problem in the country, and yet they're still clinging to this notion that it's a Western-driven phenomenon.
So it was like they were fearing Western infiltration into their society.
Yeah, they thought
via the punks
manipulated by. Yeah, they thought the punks were being manipulated by the West by a mix of sort of Westerners and Easterners who'd been shipped out of the country and who were, according to the Stasi, still pulling strings behind the scenes.
So let's talk about some of these early bands. AFS, Planlos, or Planlos, No Plan. Okay, it's one thing to be a punk; it's another thing to have a band. Where the hell are you playing?
You could, early on, they would, a lot of the buildings in the central parts of the East German cities were derelict, basically. They tended to, rather than refurbish old buildings that had been damaged during the war, they would build these high-rise complexes on the fringes of the city. And so you could go into these old sections of town and find empty spaces in the basement, and then they would soundproof it with a mix of, you know, rags and egg cartons and that kind of thing, and they just hoped nobody heard them while they were rehearsing. The concerts were pretty few and far between, especially at the beginning. They could once in a while play at some artist's studio if it was a kind of opposition-minded artist. But for the most part, they went right into the churches, and that became the home base, the sort of the concert circuit, such as it was, with a bunch of churches all around the country.
How did they spread the word, though?
They had a really effective, what they called it was a whisper network, because, like you said, there was no internet, and of course you couldn't use the phone, or you couldn't send flyers out by mail, because all that stuff was monitored. So it had to be person to person. I think that was one of the strengths of the scene, was that it was so personal. You spread all the news face to face, person to person, and the bands were converting people face to face, basically, in these relatively small scale concerts in churches.
There are several of these bands. Are there tapes of these bands still extant?
Yeah, it's mostly, if you looked on YouTube, that's the best place, because of course they were banned from the state media operations, so they couldn't really record properly, and they couldn't make records, they couldn't get on the radio, but they did make home tapes often in these basement spaces where they were rehearsing. They would just put a cassette player and record themselves, and those things, a lot of those have been uploaded. You can see that stuff.
It's incredible, because there was eventually a blanket ban put on punks in bars, cafes, and restaurants. You never know if your family's ratting on you, and yet they just sort of continued. And then they started doing graffiti, and I think that's really where it started to up the game, because they were doing incredible graffiti. Like the quote from Rosa Luxemburg, when injustice becomes law, resistance becomes a duty.
Right.
Jesus, I mean, that's revolutionary.
Yeah, the irony with that statement is that the government also officially paid tribute to Rosa Luxemburg, and yet if you did it on your own, it was suspicious or even criminal. Yeah, I did think there was something magical about the mixture of this message and the music, right? So sometimes after these church concerts, kids would literally run out the door and start spraying anti-government graffiti on the walls in the city. And one of my favorite tags is they used to write, "Don't die," well, there's a translation, "Don't die in the waiting room of the future," which I think is just a perfect sort of call to rallying cry against complacency. And I think that was sort of their great lesson to be taken from this, is that they weren't willing to sit around and hope for change. They were going to go out and try to do it themselves.
One of the punks I really was interested in, the way it ended, was really sort of weird. Otzi?
Yeah. Yeah, Otzi.
That sounds like a character and a half.
Oh, I'll say, yeah. This is basically a very anti-star scene because, of course, they didn't have media access, but also it was like I said before, a very sort of horizontally organized structure. There wasn't a star culture, and yet Otzi was kind of the only star of the entire East German punk scene. He was extremely heavy drinking and violent. even a lot of the bands from East Berlin and Leipzig didn't want to be around him and his crew because they were just so crazy. His band started in a pig stall in a little farm town in the southern part of the
country. What was the name of his band?
Schleimkind.
Which translates to
slimy germs, kind of.
It was perfect. It was absolutely perfect.
And he did a song in 84, 85 that had the lines, "We are the people, we are the power."
Right.
And in 89, when the street protests started to snowball, that was a phrase that was heard in the chants. And of course, it's really impossible to establish whether or not there's a connection, but a lot of the first protesters in Leipzig where these protests grew first were punks, because by then the punks had lost their fear of the security apparatus, and they were among the first people to be out in the street protests. And so it's possible that the great chant of the revolution comes from Otzi.
And that's the feeling you get from the book, is that they were there in the beginning. They were the first protesters that eventually led to the destruction of the Berlin Wall.
Yeah, I mean, no one group can call them.
Right.
You got to bring a lot of other people to your side.
But they were out there in the public doing it.
Yep, they were taking the beatings, taking the detainments and the jail sentences, and then just kept going. They would not stop.
Let's talk about Feeling B.
Mm-hmm.
Talk to me about that.
Feeling B, by the second half of the 80s, the Stasi realized that their sort of draconian crackdown was not having the results they wanted. So after they tried the stick, they tried the carrot. And they offered certain bands auditions for amateur performance licenses. So to perform...
Is that the Einstufung?
Einstufung, yeah. So to perform legally, even for a teenage garage band, you had to have a license that so that you could play. And they started to offer these to some of the punk bands. And this created a big break within the scene, because a lot of the hardcore sort of rejectionist punks would not do anything with the government. They did not see compromise.
They sold out. They sold out.
Yeah. But I think the bands that did get licenses, like Feeling B, was the most prominent one. I think they played an important role, too, because they were taking what was obviously a kind of implicit anti-regime statement out to these little villages and playing in official youth clubs in places where a lot of the kids might otherwise never have encountered punk and encountered people who were so clearly sort of halfway outside society.
Well, and that's the other thing that people listening have got to realize, that, yeah, there were punks in Berlin. But, you know, you go out to the countryside and there were kids there who were starting, and they're not even connected to an urban environment, and they're becoming punks.
Yeah, that was something that startled the Stasi as well. I think one of the mistakes they made on that front is that if a kid, a 15-year-old kid, sees a punk band play at a church show, right, and they go, "Wow, that is cool, that is daring, that's rebellious, I want to be part of that." And then that kid doesn't realize that 2 weeks later the band is arrested and thrown in prison because they never acknowledged the opposition activities in the press, in the Eastern press. So oftentimes the kids who were getting involved, the new subsequent generations of kids who would get involved, didn't realize the potential for the full level of what they were getting themselves into.
When they had, the second big punk event, the Stasi did everything to try to prevent people to show up.
Those reports are incredible. Yeah, they list all the checkpoints along the road.
Oh, my God.
They pull cars over. They have all the different branches of the police stationed at train stations. In the case of Otzi, they sent a cable to the town where he was from to make sure the police stopped him from leaving his family compound any time prior, in the days prior to the festival, so that he couldn't make it to play.
Yet kids still showed up.
Yeah, that was a rough one, though. The kids showed up pretty bloody. <that one. laughs>
But they showed. They would come days earlier. And
they tried to avoid the police because they you begin to see how they're going to crack down and work against that.
We're almost out of time. What happened after the fall of the wall to these kids? Like, did they feel like, okay, this is finally it, and we accomplished what we set out to?
Well, one of these bands played a gig on November 9th, 1989, the night the wall fell. And during their set, the crowd was going bananas, and they told me they were really wasted at the time, so they didn't really know what was going on. They weren't sure. Maybe they were just playing a great show. And instead, they finish, and everyone swarms them, and they go, oh, the wall fell. And they broke up the band that night. Because they realized that they'd accomplished what they'd set out to do, and that in the future the message and the music was going to have to change for a new political reality. And after the fall of the wall, a lot of the DIY energy was pumped into other areas because they realized none of the people who fought against the dictatorship wanted unification. They were almost universally seeking an independent East Germany that would work according to a more idealistic version of socialism. And so it was a big disappointment for them to lose control of the political situation in the months after the fall of the wall. And they put that energy back into the nightlife scene, basically, in East Berlin. And that's the scene that I landed in, and that's how I encountered these people. That ethos lived on in these kind of oases of ideologically driven nightlife in the East.
So what were the clubs like? And what were you playing for music?
I was playing something that I think most people think was very light. I mean, it was not the sort of typical Teutonic techno. I was playing really, really light stuff.
So no Kraftwerk.
Well, no, I would play Kraftwerk.
Oh, okay.
It was nice and light. Yeah. The only band that came out of the scene was Stereo Total, and they still tour in the U.S. sometimes. But the clubs were. It was just a magical world. The buildings were still mostly empty, and you could just get hold of a space for virtually no money, and there was no kind of licensing process, so you could just set up a gallery or a club and do something a couple times a month, and it would easily cover the rent on the building because they were so cheap. And it was just like this kaleidoscopic world being enacted, being created behind the gray facades that you would imagine. I mean, when I first arrived there, I couldn't believe that it fit all the stereotypes that I knew from growing up in Reagan America. This is, it looks just like the East Bloc I was told about. And yet you went behind the facades and you found this unbelievable scene happening.
Oh, wow. Are some of these kids actually still recognized for what they did and what they accomplished, what they dared?
A lot less so than I would wish. I mean, the clergy were in a much better position to trumpet their role in the revolution following the fall of the wall because they had contacts in the Western media. So these activists have pretty much not been recognized.
And then hopefully your book will correct that.
I certainly hope so, yeah. It was really great having a few of them at the New York launch event and
neat.
Seeing people really appreciate their...
Yeah, they deserve recognition. They really do.
Yeah.
And I hope your book does that. This is a fantastic book, and it's a really like you're there. You get a real sense of what it was like to be there at that time. My guest tonight has been writer, journalist, translator Tim Moore. And we've been talking about his book, Burning Down the House, Punk Rock, Revolution, and the Fall of the Berlin Wall. Tim, it's been a real pleasure.
Mark, thank you so much.
You listen to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.